Welcome to episode 16 of the Artist Materialist Podcast. I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And today we are discussing the article from Wired Magazine, How the Startup Mentality Failed Kids in San Francisco. This was an article that I came across on my news feed, and it just caught my eye because it contains a lot of things that I'm interested in. So I was wondering, what did you think of this particular story?
This very much follows in a number of things that I've come across over the past couple of years, as far as trying to start new schools and philanthropy in Silicon Valley is something that I've been keeping an eye on. I think that I'm particularly interested in on since you've actually dealt with middle schools more than I have, how it came across to you. But it certainly seemed that one of the sort of baseline things was this idea that you can create a tech box and that will make middle school students not be middle school students seemed like a fool's errand from the start.
Yes, that was my impression too. This school that they created, the Willie J. Brown Junior Middle School, it had everything going for it as far as infrastructure and funding, really. And even for hiring, it sounded like they hired, at least in the administration, I don't know about the teachers, it sounded like they had really did have everything going for them. And the problem is that, like you said, they didn't pay attention to the problems, the basic problems of the school. It was kind of like, if we get rid of the funding problems, everything else will take care of itself. And that seems kind of foolish in retrospect. That's something that I hear again and again, since I live in a state that does have a huge problem with poverty, especially in rural areas. We hear again and again that from teachers that, you know, we can only do so much. The real problem that we face in the classrooms is what's going on outside the classrooms. If we can deal with poverty, if we can deal with the fact that some of these kids don't have stable home lives, then schools will be better. And so it's great that they had this really nice new school to put the kids in, but it didn't address any of the systemic societal problems that plagued the kids and the school district in the first place. So it mentions that on the very first day, they had all these problems, all these incidents of violence and kids acting up and hitting each other and things. And they were just behaving the same way they would have elsewhere. And all the smart boards in the world aren't going to change that.
Well, I think one of the particularly with regards to a public school that does not have some sort of screening process to get in, you had this real disconnect between a bunch of parents because it talked about how there was all these incentives to try to make sure that very involved, choosy parents would want to send their kids there. There were all these extra STEM programs and whatnot. And part of that is that if it's going to be a public school, that means that you have a mix of people. And perhaps some of these parents were thinking of their own educational experience where maybe they went to a private school where there was a screening process and only kids who didn't have anything going on outside of school were allowed in. And it just coming up to the realization that some kids are better behaved, and you know, whether or not it's, even if you have in the most the wealthiest and most resourced community, there's still going to be some kids who act out more. And if you have some sort of test or charter process or screening process where you say, oh, no, that kid isn't allowed in, or I'm going to kick that kid out. That's different from a public school that has to educate everyone.
Yes. You have to design the curriculum and the school program with that understanding in mind. And one of the things that they mentioned, or that one of the teachers interviewed mentioned, was that there wasn't really any kind of policy learning for the teachers. They didn't know what they said. They hadn't even announced basic policies on tardiness, attendance, and misbehavior. The principal didn't say how they were going to handle kids who misbehaved. The teachers didn't know what was expected of them. And so they just had some technical training to learn this personalized learning platform, software training, which, you know, that's nice, but that's really not going to help. It's not really going to help the teachers when they need to decide how to discipline kids or how to deal with kids who aren't prepared and all that stuff. I mean, they have their own understanding, but it doesn't really give them the assurance that the principal's got their back or that other teachers are going to help them out or whatever needs to be done. And it sounds like the administration kind of fell down on the job there.
Well, it makes it a perfect analogy for Silicon Valley as a whole, where you have this incredibly resourced school, the infrastructure, there's all this money that went into it, and all this whiz-bang buildings and labs that weren't necessarily even all the way done when it opened. So it sort of opened as a beta release. And then with no resources put into the HR portion or thinking about what people might do with the thing that they've built, it's really, with what's going on in Facebook and Twitter, it's the parallels are pretty stark.
Yes, you're right. That's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. That tends to be with platforms like Facebook and Twitter. The engineers build something. Wouldn't it be cool if we had this thing that did this? And they focus on building the thing. And in a lot of tech startups, there's, or maybe this is changing now, but previously there was sort of the idea that we build the thing, the users provide the content. And content is just thought of as this amorphous thing, kind of like the cloud. It's, you don't really have to worry about it. It's just content. The users put it in there. Our job is to make the machine work and to bring the users in, and then it just runs itself. And it sounds like they kind of built the school this way. We'll build the thing, the school. We'll put all the stuff in there that needs to be in there, and then the kids will just show up. They're the content, and they will do their thing. And it doesn't work that way.
And as far as the teachers, the article does talk about how in the San Francisco school district, how teachers are really paid comparatively little, even compared to school districts that are not very far away, and how the rise in the price of living in San Francisco has really meant that the resignation rate in the San Francisco school district is extremely high, just because who can afford to live there? And if the only place you can afford to live is a 2-hour drive and the place you're driving from pays just as much or more, then that becomes very enticing.
Yes, I've read over the few past years articles about countries where teaching is considered a really noble professional profession that people aspire to, places like Finland and South Korea, and teachers are paid on par with, you know, attorneys or other professional jobs. And especially someplace like San Francisco, where even though I know I could get a 3-figure job if I moved there, I wouldn't do it because I know my quality of life would go so far downhill because I would be living in a rented shack somewhere if I were lucky.
It was a little surprising to see how much of a, it's sort of a reverse problem in some ways compared to a lot of the stories that have been coming out about places like Oklahoma, where teachers are, where the state has just basically decided that we don't like teachers and so we'll pay them nothing. And so they say, okay, well, we can't afford to keep teaching in Oklahoma. So if we'd like to support our local community, but we have to go drive across the border to Texas where we, for our teaching job, so we can get paid enough to live on. And this is almost, is a, in San Francisco, it's a different sort of a problem, but kind of the same result, where it's almost, we can't afford to cross over the border between counties from the place that we can afford to live into San Francisco to work. So we're just going to stay where we're living and teach there. It's a parallel, but a different sort of a problem.
Well, and it's something that, I mean, we have where I live too, is the problem of being able to recruit teachers because the salaries aren't high enough. I mean, my state is pretty low down on the national teacher salary. We're not the worst, but we're certainly not anywhere near the top. And so that does make it hard to recruit teachers. And if you look at just pure numbers, I'm sure San Francisco looks pretty good, but in terms of cost of living and how much that pays for a cost of living, it's probably dismal, probably even worse than rural South Carolina.
Well, the article talks about, you know, the first principal is like, well, it looked like his salary was pretty good, but, and he got a bit of a raise coming from Chicago, but Chicago has a quarter of the housing price. So that's a pretty, pretty big difference.
Yeah. And another problem that this school had was turnover, especially among the principals. Apparently they're on their fourth principal right now, I believe. Looking at, yes, the fourth principal as of this article coming out. And the first principal barely made it through the year. He didn't even make it through the first year before he bailed. And they brought in other people. And they interviewed the third principal. And he said that, you know, the teachers, about the time he came in, the teachers started quitting. And they had trouble with the software that was supposed to make this school so special. And it's just, the school was really falling apart. And I can see why, you know, it would be hard to retain any good administrators and teachers in a situation like that.
I should really talk some more about this with friends of mine who are teachers, but it does seem that these software systems have become very important. I guess as a parent, you probably interact with them a little bit, but there's these software systems that are probably each school system at this point has them. Maybe this one had its own special one that was not what people were used to, which probably didn't help.
Education software is its whole own set of problems. I've interacted with it some. Actually, when I was working for USC, I was working to develop some classroom software. And so I have a little bit of understanding of some of the problems with it. We were trying to overcome those. And I've interacted with a lot of the education software, and a lot of it is pretty terrible, I will say. It's clunky, it's hard to use. There are certain testing platforms that are ubiquitous, especially in college, that break all the time during tests or have problems allowing people to enter the correct answer, things like that. And really the way that education software works right now is the big players, the companies that have the most money, are the ones that are able to sell to school districts, the biggest school districts. And it kind of trickles down from there. You know, the sales rep comes in, they sell to the district, and the district office says, okay, everybody, all these schools, here's what you're going to be using. And you kind of get stuck with something that maybe does or doesn't work.
Right. You had one successful go-getter salesperson who sold the system whether or not it existed at the time that a big school district was looking to buy something. And then ever since then, it's probably, oh, well, now we're locked into this system. We don't want to change. And who knows how much it costs initially and on an ongoing basis.
And some of it can be useful. I have something called Power School. That's what one of my kids' schools use. It's allows me to see their grades. It's a little bit clunky. The interface is kind of confusing. It's one of those things. It's a lot like sort of business intranet software, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, and you know how dismal that can be when you try to find any information or find the piece of information you're looking for, and everything's organized in a way that doesn't make sense to you, and there's so much useless stuff, so many useless menus that are empty because nobody really needs them there. It's kind of designed as a one-size-fits-all solution, and then the teachers end up just using one little tiny part of it because the rest of it isn't worth their trouble. So that's kind of how it goes. Yeah, there's also something called Class Dojo, which is a little more successful, and that is really just an elementary school communication tool that the teacher uses to tell you if your student had a good week with good behavior or a bad week with bad behavior, and you can kind of get an idea of how good or bad their week was behavior-wise, and the teacher can send out little messages to the parents and let them know what's going on in the classroom and post pictures and stuff. And that's actually really useful, but it's a very focused tool. It's just for communication. It's not meant to be, you know, grades and testing and communication and everything. And I think that's why it's useful.
And I think that's, and that, I think that comes to, it was, and that was probably, my guess is that a teacher who was actively being a teacher had a part in that. It's like, this is what I need, is I need something that lets me communicate with the parents. And whereas what a little bit of what the school comes across is, this is the school that tech funders thought would be exciting for their childhood.
Yes. And especially they talk about how they wanted to use this Summit software to teach the classes. And when they couldn't use the software, they had no way to actually teach a class. It says they had, you know, 80-minute class period, and all of a sudden they couldn't use the curriculum they'd planned because it was all based around this software. When the contract with the software company wasn't renewed, it completely broke down everything. And I think that's a single point of failure that should not have been allowed in this particular workflow.
So, and also going with the funding, one of the things I found interesting about this is this, the whole world of philanthropy in Silicon Valley, since nowadays that's like where a huge portion of the new wealth in America is concentrated, within San Francisco. And there's a natural inclination to support local philanthropy. And so on the one hand, you have potentially this almost limitless funds, and they talk about how easy it was to get the building funded. But on the other hand, it's, if you're only funding philanthropy that's very, very local, what's that doing in terms of the whole country and the world in terms of where philanthropic dollars go? And that made me think of this Silicon Valley Community Foundation, which, for, I don't know if it's, maybe it's receded a little bit, but for a while it was sort of the main big philanthropy in the Silicon Valley. And so it was extremely well funded. And you kind of wonder, well, what's it doing with all of that money? And is that the best use of the money? And as you were talking about before, is any of that money going towards systemic change that really makes things better for people?
I would argue that actually local philanthropy in this case would have been a great way to solve many of these problems. I read recently that California had some of the worst income inequality in the whole country. Mm-hmm. There are communities with terrible systemic poverty, and they're maybe not in Silicon Valley. Some of them might be. I'm sure they are near Silicon Valley. There's a lot of inland areas. You know, the one place I was reading about was near Bakersfield, and they could really be helped by some sort of grant program or infusion of philanthropy. And I don't know, maybe that's just not on their radar. I mean, in this case, something that maybe could have helped would be to subsidize housing for the teachers so that they wouldn't have felt, you know, so stressed about their commutes and their low salaries. That sounds like that's something that certainly could have been afforded in this case.
It does talk about the Salesforce CEO, Mark Benioff, that he has just sort of blanketly given the school principals a blanket $100,000 to do things with, and has also supported an increase in a parcel tax for teacher salaries. And that seems like a much higher leverage action.
Yes.
Where, you know, that if you can't solve, then that's one of these things that people talk about is like, well, is if you really want to solve these things, the way to do it isn't to just say, oh, rich person, give us some of your money and solve all the problems. It's okay, let's change the tax structure so that even the people who are misanthropic curmudgeons have to pay their fair share as well. And then we can really have enough money to do things properly.
Yep. And I notice we're talking a lot here about the principals and teachers. And I see there's this one part of the article that mentions many studies in education have been done. And the one thing that most closely correlates with good student outcomes is the presence of good teachers and principals who stick around. And I'm sure they had good teachers. The teachers didn't have enough resources to maybe be successful, it sounds like, but they certainly weren't paid a whole lot. And they did have, the school had a lot of trouble with principals sticking around since they're on their fourth principal already. However, this new principal sounds like he's doing things differently. And I kind of like what I read about him, that he is approaching being the principal of this school, not as being the principal of this fancy new high-tech school, but just as being a middle school principal. And he's just looking at it as any other middle school principal job and trying to build rapport with the students and the teachers and build a school culture. And that sounds like he might be the one who's successful here.
Right. The idea of a culture, and this goes to the, you know, this is a new school, but then there's always the talk about schools that are closing since there's kind of a population dip that has started to come a little bit as far as younger students is, you know, varies from place to place. But if you have a neighborhood school that has a long presence in a community, then there's a real connection to it. And you probably have teachers that have been there a long time and they may stay just out of loyalty or they have connections to the area. Whereas here you have a new school with teachers who probably commute quite a ways. And if there's no existing culture, you have to create it. But as the interview with that principal was saying, that in an educational setting, it does not take very long to establish a new, you know, new traditions, a new culture. And I've certainly experienced that myself just as a student. If you do something for 2 years in a row at that age, I mean, that's a tradition.
Yep.
Does it take much?
I was struck by the difference between this particular school and a school in my own district, which is was recently certified as a STEM magnet school. And it was just a regular rural middle school. And the teachers and principals decided to get together and do what needed to be done to get their school certified as a STEM magnet, because then they could easily transfer in kids from around the district. And since it was a small school, they could get more enrollment. And it's been pretty successful. They've did a good job transforming this ordinary rural middle school into a STEM magnet school, adding different things to the curriculum, putting in a tech lab, things like that. But they don't have a huge amount of resources. Now they do have, donations from local businesses and things like that, and that's helped. The local tech companies, of which there are not that many, but they're gradually getting there, gradually improving and working through this. I think they're only on like the third year of the being an official STEM school. And so it's interesting to see how that school worked as opposed to this one, where they had the existing school and they're kind of trying to work towards, obviously it's not going to be as fancy, it's never going to be as fancy as the San Francisco school was, but they're kind of working in the same direction to be a place that's a public school where any student can go, can choose to go and get a good STEM education, as opposed to just sort of creating the school from scratch, creating the STEM education and then filling it with students and hoping it works.
I'm curious, this particular school, was it the case that there was declining enrollment just because of where people are living now, or was there a specific reason why they decided they needed to attract more people there?
It's always been a small school, and you're funded by the state per pupil. So if you can attract more students, you get more funding. And because it's a rural school and its enrollment has never been all that high, the county isn't really growing in that direction. It's growing on the other, on the sort of the west side of the county, and this is in the south side. So, in order to keep their enrollment up, they decided to do this. And it was good timing because at the time the two middle schools in the center of the county, I guess three middle schools, but two of them were and are really crowded to the point of being overcrowded. So they were hoping to capitalize on that and attract some of the students from the overcrowded schools down to their school.
That's a very it's an interesting contrast. It's a case that I haven't heard anybody talk about. I've definitely heard the situation where there's schools that are closing and protests against why are you closing this neighborhood school and not that neighborhood school, or situations where there's programs to allow for students to go to the most popular schools or to restrict going to the most popular schools. But this is a it makes a lot of sense that if there's a school that's undersubscribed to put additional resources in there. And I think that was part of the idea with this startup school, was that they would try to attract students from a variety of places into a neighborhood where that would otherwise not necessarily be popular. But they went about it by just let's blue sky it, start from nothing and dream big, which is a very San Francisco thing to do, and it turns out just as messy as a lot of other things that when you do it that way.
Yes. I wonder what would have happened if they'd taken one of the failing or closing schools and just sort of renovated it, kept the existing students and changed the curriculum. I mean, that sounds like a lot more work than starting from scratch, but I wonder if it would have been more successful.
Or, well, there's this thing though where the parents that are likely to complain and likely to pull their kids out if there's anything happening, if there's any slight disruptions, are the same parents that are critical to really making a school work well. They're the very involved parents who volunteer for things and raise extra money for art supplies and all of that sort of thing. And so I can understand why it would make sense to go through some extra effort to try to attract more highly involved parents, even though it ends up being that some of them decide that it's not for them.
That's true. I mean, that's one thing that no amount of school funding or anything will be able to change in a school is getting the involved parents there and keeping them there. That's really one thing that public schools, especially in my local public school district, that they worry about is losing the really involved parents to private schools or homeschooling. And I do know a few parents who, because they had problems with whatever school their kids were in, they did send their schools to private schools just because they tried to fix whatever was going wrong and the administration wouldn't listen, or for whatever reason, they bailed on them. So it's very important to keep parents happy as well.
And they can be on either side of that. They can either be the parent of the child who is very much follows all of the rules and is easily spooked by more boisterous activity around them. Or they could be the parent of a child who's the one who's misbehaving, but it's not, of course, it's not their precious angel's fault that they're creating all the disruption. So it can really go either way.
Yes, definitely. Well, I'm going to be curious to see what happens to this school in the future and how well it's doing maybe a year or 2 years from now. It sounds like it's on the upswing, and it sounds like they've got a principal with a good understanding of what it's going to take to improve the way that things are going. So I hope that they do well.
Yes, and for we'll attach a link to the show notes about the former superintendent of San Francisco schools, who's now in charge of the New York schools, and all of the battles that he's been fighting as far as school integration, which is a whole other thing.
Oh, I could go on forever about that. That's a big deal down here. And I should add that that's another reason that they wanted to add the STEM certification, was to keep the student population well integrated and balanced.
That's it for another episode of Artist Materialist. You can find us at artistmaterialist.wordpress.com. Please rate and review and share with anyone you think might find this interesting.